You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution to P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for March 1st, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside Justice Scalia's Sensitivity Awareness Workshop, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal. Recorded live from just outside Roman Catholicism, two popes, no waiting, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
I think it's more like no popes too waiting.
Yeah, man, the news is full of shit that other people think I should find interesting, Blue Gal. And I just don't.
The Pope's helicopter?
Don't.
It's not interesting.
Care, not since the white Bronco chase.
Oh, yeah.
Of the O.J. Simpson era, which I must say I converted into a lovely. The only good thing that came out of that for me personally, because it's all about me, Blue Gal, was riffing on a famous poem about white chickens in a wheelbarrow.
What?
Yeah, I know. It so much depends on a white Ford Bronco and two gloves.
I'm sure a lot of people remember where they were when they saw the white Ford Bronco.
I was in writing class, and we were all so just appalled that our time was being wasted. I thought, wait a minute, this sounds like a famous John Dos Passos poem. I'm not sure if it's John Dos Passos, but it's so much depends on. It's a doctor looking out of a window of a hospital. Very short poem. I cannot do it from memory, but so much depends on the rain-glazed wheelbarrow and two chickens. And it's a very short poem, but it's sort of the tenuousness of farm life. Mm-hmm. That without these two or three simple things, the whole farm collapses. The whole thing collapses. And I thought, wait a minute. So much depends
on the white Ford Bronco.
On a white Ford Bronco and blood glazed gloves or something, and we all had a good laugh about that. But
that's funny.
Yeah, because
I was at a Tarbox Ramblers concert at a bar.
Oh God!
With my friend Jill, and we were listening to the Tarbox Ramblers, and then all of a sudden, all the waitresses in the bar started watching the TV, and then a couple of the band members started watching the TV. So Michael Tarbox, the lead singer, finally just stopped playing and said, and turned to the television and said, "Why is he going to his mother's house?" Ah. And I yelled out from the audience, "She's got a ham waiting." And that was it.
Ah. I'm sorry. Let me make a slight correction, because it would be terrible if we went much further without me correcting my screw up. That's William Carlos Williams.
Oh, okay.
And it so much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens, which doing that from memory from 20 years ago, whatever it was, I think is pretty fair.
All right. We've indulged ourselves enough. Yeah. Let's talk about Scalia.
I want to talk about Robert Heinlein, but I suppose I have to talk about Antonin Scalia.
Well, I particularly want to talk about this because again, as you say, it's all about us.
Yeah.
And, this Voting Rights Act thing has come about because Shelby County, Alabama, has decided to challenge the Voting Rights Act, specifically Section 5. And there is a direct connection to me in that I lived in Shelby County, Alabama for 11 years. So I know Shelby County quite intimately.
And then you
left. Out of there in 2008. Yeah.
You're sort of doing the silly shit. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I know a lot about Shelby County and how things kind of are there. And Shelby County is overwhelmingly white. It's like 79% white. It's one of the top 100 richest counties in America.
Uh-huh.
It's a lot of doctors. It's a lot of attorneys, a lot of professors at the university. And there is so much housing discrimination in Alabama just by price. And by real estate agents just assuming that African Americans can't afford things and steering them to black neighborhoods, there's just a lot of housing discrimination. I find it really interesting that it's Shelby County doing this and saying, well, we're not racist.
No, we're not racist.
We're not racist anymore. You know,
no.
This isn't 1965. Well, they have solved these problems, you know.
Sure.
By making it a, you know, 7% black community.
Yeah, problem solved.
Fine.
Yeah. Vote all you want.
Vote all you want. And so I wanted to read what Scalia said and comment on it, because I think I think Scalia is making some valid points, but they aren't about voting rights. And I think exploring this is important. So the first thing he said that kind of shocked people, he said, this last enactment, not a single vote in the Senate against it. This was extending the Voting Rights Act for 25 years in 2006. The House pretty much the same. Now, I don't think that's attributable to the fact that it is so much clearer now that we need this. I think it is attributable, very likely attributable, to a phenomenon that is called perpetuation of racial entitlement. And that's when people gasped.
Yes.
It's been written about, whenever a society adopts racial entitlements, it is very difficult to get out of them through the normal political processes.
Yes.
Says.
Sometimes you have to wage a civil war. Oh, I'm thinking of white racial entitlement.
Oh, wait a minute.
That's right.
That's different.
That's right. That's a different racial entitlement.
When did we adopt that? Never. We were born with it, right?
Yeah. Well,
our nation was born with it. That's what I mean.
I know you're on a roll, and I don't want to take you off this track, but I would like to indulge our audience by quoting from another person writing about racial entitlement, who wrote, they assume the Negro is equal and hence conclude that he is entitled to equal privileges and rights with the white man. If their premises were correct, their conclusions would be logical and just, but their premise being wrong, their whole argument fails. And then this writer goes on to describe people who believe such things as insane and ludicrous and blah, blah, blah. They were attempting to make things equal, which the creator had made unequal. Yeah. That was the vice president of the Confederacy of the United States, yeah. Alexander Stevens, explaining why racial entitlement is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Except when you're white.
Except when you're white.
The idea that black people should feel entitled to vote is disastrous and ruinous. And by God, if we let this crap go forward, we'll never be rid of it. So
that's the point. Is I like that Scalia said adopt. Whenever a society adopts racial entitlements. No, the white people didn't adopt racial entitlements in the United States. They were born with them.
We built this city on rock and roll, my friend.
We did.
We built this fucking country on racial entitlements.
Racial entitlements. They're just white entitlements.
Yes.
And so, number one, voting rights should be up to the courts, is what he's arguing, rather than the Congress. But the whole point is, and he says, you know, Congress will never vote against voting rights. Of course they won't. But the Voting Rights Act gives voters the right to sue in federal court. That's the whole point of the Voting Rights Act is to get it to the court.
Where else are you allowed to bring a lawsuit other than court, Tony? So,
and then I just wrote down in my notes, you know, this thing is too popular in a democracy to be decided upon by elected officials.
Yeah. Can't have that.
Can't have that. No. So this other part that he talked about really rang a bell with me in terms of Alabama. He said, Scalia said, there are certain districts in the House that are black districts by law just about now.
Uh-huh.
And even the Virginia senators, they have no interest in voting against this. I don't know where he got that. Like, even the Virginia senators.
Well, he can read minds. Tony's can read the thoughts of others because he, you know, he understands everyone else's motives for everything they do.
The state government is not their government. They're going to lose votes if they do not reenact the Voting Rights Act. Okay. I want to talk about this black congressional districts by law issue because it's actually kind of true.
Yes. And as black wards in Chicago are true,
exactly.
But the reason behind them is important to understand.
It is. And it's a symptom of racial discrimination, not the solution to racial discrimination.
The point was, go ahead.
I wanted to talk a little bit about a state house member named Patricia Todd in Alabama. Patricia Todd. She won a Democratic primary in a historically black district. That's what they call them, historically black districts.
Yeah.
And she was well known in her district for public service, but she was not black. She was a white woman who happened to be lesbian.
Uh-huh.
And
happened to be, huh?
She happened to be lesbian. Well, and she got her street cred in her community by doing AIDS activism. And a lot of people knew her and know her as being someone who works in the community for the community. So it wasn't just, she didn't just drop in from the sky and get elected. She's somebody who really people trusted would do constituent services. On the other hand, there were four Black candidates running against her, and their votes, as for people that were going to just vote based on race, those votes were split.
Yeah. Yes. Happens all the time.
And so she received more votes than four other candidates, but they had to have a runoff. And she ran against a woman, another woman named Gaynell Hendricks, who was an African-American businesswoman. And she won. She won the June primary. She won the July runoff. Uh-huh. Todd did. White lesbian woman.
White lesbian Todd. Okay.
White lesbian won this House, Democratic House nomination.
In a historically Black district.
In a historically Black district. Now, the Democratic State Party of Alabama has a vice chairman of minority affairs named Joe Reed. And Joe Reed tried to stop Patricia Todd from being the Democratic nominee. There was a rule that had been discontinued about filing your campaign finances that they all of a sudden decided was tremendously important. Mm-hmm. And it was a campaign finance rule that hadn't been enforced for 20 years. And they just decided, well, we're just going to disqualify Todd over this finance rule. But then there was quite an outrage about that. And the party executive committee overturned that. Largely on racial lines, but there was some crossover, they said.
See, it gets very tangled, doesn't it?
Well, it really does. And the thing is, I attended a luncheon that week that was going on, a Democratic luncheon. And it was, people were just, and this was a pretty liberal group, because if you're a Democrat in Alabama and you're willing to appear at lunch based on whether you're a Democrat or not, that means you're out there. I attended this lunch and everyone there was really horrified that a winner of a primary and someone who had won a primary and had the most votes in the primary and then had a runoff and won the runoff was now being held up over race.
Yeah.
And a good liberal AIDS activist to boot.
Right.
I mean, you know, this is not the DLCC coming in and saying, we're going to pick this candidate. She's a real deal.
She's a homegrown. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the Democratic activists who was attending this lunch said, oh, yeah, Joe Reed wouldn't care if she was gay, straight, bisexual or a Siamese twin. But she has to be Black because it's a Black district. And it really that episode, which, you know, she is now representing that district and she's in the news all the time on liberal blogs because she does good liberal stuff for her district in Alabama. But it was a real lesson to me that these historic Black districts are seen as, you know,
kingdoms
of these politicians.
Absolutely. Yeah. Abso-fucking-lutely.
I know you know about this from Chicago. But the thing is that it's settling. It's settling for having this kingdom as opposed to having statewide power.
Absolutely, yeah.
This has happened in North Carolina, too, because I heard about this on Colbert, where the state house, the white state house, white-dominated state house of North Carolina is happy to draw the state house districts so that there are Black districts.
Sure.
So long as they're majority white districts. The majority of districts are white Republican districts. And so the state house will always be Republican. There's never been a Black governor of Alabama. There's never been a Black governor of North Carolina. There's never been a Black governor of Texas. The first elected Black governor since Reconstruction was Douglas Wilder in Virginia, which was in, you know, my adult lifetime.
Yeah.
These southern, you know, and now we have Deval Patrick in Massachusetts, and there's a couple of other ones. But really, this is about sacrificing statewide power and national power to get this little kingdom.
Well, this is
gods and, you know,
but at one
stuff from your position.
But at one level, it's brilliant
It is.
It's okay. Old school Machiavellian politics.
It absolutely
play
is.
Play one group off against the other.
Mm-hmm.
This is what happened in Chicago's South and West sides for years. This is why the Stroger family became a dynasty in Cook County. Mm-hmm. It's because they took care of the Daley family's dirty laundry.
Oh.
They took care of the Daley's political. They were part of the Daley political machine. This is why you had black districts on the South Side, aldermen. It was you segregate a whole bunch of black folks into a small neighborhood, put someone over them who is loyal to Daley.
Yeah, yeah.
And that person has a job for life.
Yep.
He's completely loyal uphill. He will do the minimum necessary to take care of his district, but there'll be no power base because the entire political machine is set up to make sure that no opposition ever rises up to the Daley family. Mm-hmm. And so you have these little fiefdoms where the perks and privileges and the lovely $1,200 suits and the 4-point pocket handkerchiefs mm-hmm. and the immaculately tied ties of the aldermen are the evidence of their prosperity.
Yeah.
And their power. And they don't want to give that up. And they don't want to really change the status quo at all. Now, that has changed. It changed. I just looked it up. 30 years ago, this April.
Harold Washington.
Harold Washington became the first,
I knew it.
First black mayor of Chicago ever. And Chicago was a blue Democratic city. Still is. There has been no Republican mayor of Chicago since Big Bill Thompson during the Capone era. That's how long Democratic Party has held Chicago. There is, to my knowledge, one Republican alderman, maybe. He might be gone by now. I don't know. But it's a Democratic city. It's a single-party system. Mm-hmm. But the minute Harold Washington did exactly what this woman did, he split the vote.
Yeah.
It was young Richie Daley, a state's attorney, versus Jane Byrne.
Yeah.
And Richie Daley made the mistake of talking in public. And, you know, his tenuous relationship.
Not the most articulate person on the planet.
No. And Harold Washington was people started hearing him talk in public. He's very smart, a rich and lovely command of the English language, and extremely good on his feet. Very good in a fight. Mm-hmm. Made Daley look stupid, made Byrne look out of touch, and he ran right up the middle. And his coalition of
the
perfect liberal coalition, you know, white liberals, progressives, LGBT community before there, I think they were called that. Mm-hmm. African Americans, Hispanics, all these sort of dispossessed groups rallied to this cause,
mm-hmm.
and all of the Beltway white folks became Republicans overnight.
Yeah, yeah.
All of them. They ran. They did not walk there. And this is what I really fault Barack Obama for never learning the lesson of Harold Washington.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The minute the color of the mayor changed, they all rallied to a guy named Bernie Epton.
Before it's too late.
Epton's motto.
Wasn't that his motto?
It's too late. Bernie Epton, before it's too late. An obscure nobody. But suddenly all these bungalow belt Democrats from the Polish neighborhoods, the Irish neighborhoods, these are my people, suddenly discovered they're inner Republican. And suddenly the city council, which had been a rubber stamp body for Daley forever and was going to be a rubber stamp body for the son of Daley forever, during this brief period suddenly found its voice and decided to unilaterally oppose every single fucking thing Harold Washington tried to do. That's politics. And out of that welter of power and privilege and position and promises and a lot of other words that start with P, I'm sure, mm-hmm. comes this sense that this district is mine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can understand that, because when you've had nothing and you finally carved out a place for yourself where you control the businesses and you control the churches and you control the police force.
And who gets the jobs? Yeah. Then, who gets the jobs to go to Washington, D.C. as an intern or whatever it is? Yeah.
Some well-intentioned white liberal shows up and says, now we're all going to share. No.
No, we're not. And I get that. But at the same time, mm-hmm. there's been, and this is true just as much of Harold Washington, as you say, as it is of Barack Obama. There was absolutely no incentive for African-American politicians in Alabama who had their little state house district to push for 100% black voter registration and 100% black turnout until Barack Obama ran for president.
Yes.
Because their districts were safe.
Yeah.
So there was no, why should I go into another district and start working to drive up black voter registration? There's nothing in it for me to do that, mm-hmm. except, you know, the good of the country. But that's not, you know, I'm busy. I have other things to do. So now there has been. And the turnout, I was looking at turnout numbers for African Americans in Alabama, and it was like 79, 82, 85% in some districts.
Yeah.
In 2012.
Well, and if you want to see an example of where this, of what a possible future looks like, a genuinely sort of, because people are going to have their identities, they're going to vote for their own kind, depending on what they define their kind as.
Right, and people like themselves. Right. That's what you always hear at business conferences.
But go down to 79th and Racine in Chicago. Go to St. Sabina's Church. It's the one with the big black Jesus on the wall.
Okay.
The gigantic, gigantic mural of black Jesus on the wall.
I'm going to just off topic that someone copyrighted the name Jesus. It's trying to copyright it.
Yeah. Apparently, this is part of the Pope's post-Pope business plan.
Jesus Jeans is trying to copyright the name Jesus for their company.
Good for them.
Good luck with that.
But you go down to St. Sabina's, and you'll see Father Mike Flager, who's the whitest white guy you'll ever want to see.
Really? Wow.
And is beloved, or last I checked, beloved by his community, is an excellent pastor, an excellent brother in Christ, led protests against every blight of urban community you could imagine, from liquor to tobacco ads to everything, gone to jail or been threatened to jail, was an embarrassment to the Catholic Church on more than one occasion because he wouldn't shut up. I went down there years and years ago to see, I think, Maya Angelou speak. And it's a rockin' Southside African-American church with a very white priest, and they all get along fine. And so that's what it can look like when it's working well. Social activism, the people in charge are live in the community, roll up their sleeves, obviously are there for life, mm-hmm. and are deeply invested and win over the trust of the people they're pastoring to or they're leading. But the flip side also has to be true. And that's what's happening now. We have a guy in the White House who doesn't look like me.
Yep.
Who does some things I severely disagree with, and some things I think that he deserves credit for. But that's what we're supposed to look like. And I don't know where, when we cross the threshold, but we haven't crossed it yet. So Tony,
no, we haven't.
Suck my dick, because that's we're not there yet. And sorry, but if you have if you're the guy who helped Robert Bork destroy the fair doctrine, and you've been an enemy of every kind of progressive idea since the day you were decanted from whatever hellhole you came from, and you and Roberts have been anti-voter rights forever, then screw you. I want to hear Clarence Thomas talk about this issue.
Yep.
That's who I want to hear from. Yeah. But, of course, we'll probably hear
we've always
heard from him, which is, whatever Tony said is okay with me. Because that's his job.
Yep. But I guess the last thing I want to say about this is that it's not about race. After we talked about race for 20 minutes, this is now about the Republican Party, and we're covering it up by talking about race. It's the fact that one party is nearly all white.
Yeah.
And it wants to get power and keep it.
Yes.
So, you know, Scalia can say, well, there's less racism now. It's just an entitlement that makes people renew the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah,
no. It's the power. It's whether or not we're going to give the Democratic Party the right to defend itself against voter suppression based on race.
Yeah.
That's what it's about.
Well, based on the whim of whoever happens to be in charge,
in the state house.
Yeah. Regardless of their motives and regardless of their skin color, you don't get to tell a group of people arbitrarily, you people don't get to vote, you people do, or we're going to make it harder for you for one group than another. You don't get to do that.
Nope.
And that's what the Voting Rights Act is.
And should
period. And it's been invoked and cited as recently as 5 minutes ago, thanks to the 2012 election. So it's not like it's gone out of style. It's not like we don't need it any longer.
Let's talk about Jesse Jackson III.
Speaking of
what's going on there in Chicago.
Historic black districts.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that not only were most of the candidates on the Democratic side with the noted exception of Debbie Halverson, who lost because of her gun record, we think. But the two Republicans duking it out for their side of the ticket are both African Americans.
Yeah.
And
they're going to split that all seven votes, apparently.
Well, apparently one's ahead by 23 votes, and he's an ex-convict.
Yeah.
Who is, and good for him if he served his time and, you know, come out of it and is now running for office. But there's something very suspicious about this in terms of the party. The Republican Party is horrified that this person
You're trying really hard not to say Alan Keyes, aren't you?
I'm trying to not to say Alan Keyes. No, this guy's name is McKinley. He served 20 years in state prison for burglaries, armed robberies, and aggravated battery. And he now holds a 23-vote lead over businessman Eric Wallace, who's also African-American. The Chicago Tribune reports Wallace has not yet conceded, calling the idea of McKinley representing the party an embarrassment.
Yeah, well.
McKinley has declared victory in the race, and apparently Republican leaders have expressed dismay and concern over this. The thing I found interesting, I went and looked these guys up, and one of the big things that McKinley, Paul McKinley, the ex-convict who is winning this race so far on the Republican side,
yeah,
one of the things he's done to distinguish himself is wear a big, huge yellow lapel button that says marriage equals one man, one woman.
That's nice. That's nice for him.
So,
well, first of all, I would like to find these Republican leaders who use phrases like embarrassment.
Yeah. And dismay. Yes.
And cultivate them in maybe a petri dish of some kind. Because apparently there's some Republican leadership out there who are capable of feeling embarrassment and dismay. Yeah,
they are impervious to shame.
Yeah, over the behavior of their candidate. So,
isn't it?
Like, wow, that's a fucking discovery. That's a rare thing. That's like iridium. You know,
tell me about a bit about this district.
Because you
lived in Chicago for a long time, and did not live in this district, let's be clear, but you certainly knew a lot of people who lived in this district.
Yeah. Oh, it takes a chunk of Chicago in the south suburbs, and it's a historically black district. But before Jesse Jackson III, who is, you know, was cultivated as the Michael Corleone, and not criminally, but as the sort of the next generation inheritor of his father's position, his father's name, you know, his father did the first generation thing, which is break ground and offend a lot of people and sort of establish a franchise. And the Jackson family has resources. They're not poor. The son is much more corporate. I remember him being interviewed with his dad on, I think, Charlie Rose a million years ago. And Jesse Jackson had the whole corporate.
Jesse Jackson III.
Jesse Jackson III had the whole corporate thing down. He didn't disavow his father, but he distanced sort of.
He wasn't doing the Rainbow Coalition thing. He was doing the
much
I'm going to wear
down.
A suit, be a politician,
and
market myself in a certain way that makes me accessible to whites as well.
Well, his wife also resigned.
Yeah.
Because she was an alderman in Chicago. So this is
a dynasty going.
Please understand, when you are discussing Chicago politics, you have to think of the French royal court, because it's fucking dynastic. And it took me a long time to really wrap my head around the fact about how deep it goes. But way on down to the junior assistant commission level, the director level, it at least was last time I checked, dynastically driven, who you know, which family's your friend. Yeah. The only reason Blagojevich was ever anything other than a hack is because he married Dick Mell's daughter, and Dick Mell's a powerful alderman. So if you haven't read it, go read Boss by Mike Royko from the 70s, and just add a number after each name. So, you know, John Stroger is now Todd Stroger. Jesse Jackson II is now Jesse Jackson III. The Ickes family are there. The Daly's families are there. Seriously, once you start looking under the hood, it's the five families and their friends and their consigliaries run this state. And you have to be tight with them, or you have to go to high school with them, or you have to help them bury a hooker or something, or else you're just disposable. And if you're on, and there are things, this is a bit of a a wide circumlocution, but there were things that were rumored to be called clout lists, which is the names of protected people. Here's a list of people who always will get a job. Here's a list of people you cannot fire. And everyone sort of knew about them until during the hired truck scandal, they found them. There was some discovery being done by the Better Government Association, among others. And they found on a guy's computer one of what is presumed to be many, many lists of people, some of whom I know, who are very nice people, but who are protected. That is Chicago politics. Always has been, probably always will be. Into that dynasty, into that world, comes the Jackson family, who are a power on the South Side. Before them, before Jesse Jackson III was in that seat and is now going to jail, Mel Reynolds was in that seat, who went to jail. Mel Reynolds did not steal campaign contributions. Mel Reynolds just couldn't keep his hands off of underage Catholic schoolgirls. Or at least flirt with him. He was, you know, a young up and coming firebrand with a very good education and sort of the corporate type. He was, oh no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to be too inflammatory in our rhetoric. We're going to rise above that. Before Mel Reynolds, there was the awful Gus Savage.
And these are all people from this specific congressional district.
Yeah. And I don't recall that Gus Savage went to jail, but Gus Savage was just an awful person who held on to power because he was not afraid to play any card he needed to play to hang on to power.
I wanted to let you know that I did look up Gus Savage while you've been talking. Yeah. Apparently in 1989, he made an official visit to Zaire where he was accused of fondling a Peace Corps volunteer.
Yeah, sounds like Gus.
He called the story a lie and said his political enemies would use this against him.
Yes. He was a pioneer of that kind of denialism.
This Washington Post article goes on to say, the House Ethics Committee decided that the events did occur, but decided against any disciplinary action because Savage wrote a letter to the Peace Corps volunteer saying that he, quote, never intended to offend her.
Yeah, that sounds... But that is the history of the 2nd Congressional District in Illinois. You have up in Chicago, Isaac Carruthers, Alderman Isaac Carruthers, who went to jail for the same crime his father, Alderman Isaac Carruthers, went to jail for. We are the only state in the union that have consecutive back-to-back governors in jail at the same time of different parties.
Yes.
This is normal Illinois politics. This is the way it's played.
Well, and Jesse Jackson has other issues. I mean, he's had a drug problem. He's had other problems. And I hope he is getting some healing from that, obviously he's going to go to jail now, so that's...
Speaking of Illinois politics...
We can talk for just a minute about Bob Woodward.
Apparently, Bob Woodward saw his shadow. So now we're going to have 6 more weeks of fear.
Well, now, tell me... You've told me about this story this morning, and I've been reading a little bit about it, but why don't you give our listeners... Because Bob Woodward feels threatened, and I guess he's going
to
be on
Hannity.
To
explain the fearfulness of the fear, yes.
He was threatened by someone in the White House who told him that if he wrote this story, the story would be wrong.
Well, apparently, this is literally a 1-day story, 2-day story. And it's already become, you know, my take on it is that he screwed his reputation up so badly that very shortly he'll be offered a Sunday show and a column in the New York Times.
He'll be on Meet the Press.
Yeah. Is it Tom Brokaw fucked up? No, it's about David Gregory fucked up. Bob Woodward, who is the shaman, the holy wise man of the Washington journalist crowd who can do no wrong, who please don't mistake him for a liberal, please don't mistake him for a Democrat. He is a friend to the powerful and has been for a very, very long time, is flogging a book that, unlike his other 40 books that he got based on anonymous sourcing from powerful people that are all his friends, isn't going very well. So you can take that as background. So he's doing a book and he's doing a report on the sequester, and he's apparently chasing down a blind alley having to do with who struck John, you know, who's responsible, who did what, who said what, when did the president ever ask for taxes? I don't know, some weird little detail of the story. And he and White House, I forget his title, but I think it's economics person, Gene Sperling, it is now revealed, had an exchange over email. And the exchange was apparently preceded by a very polite and cordial conversation in which Mr. Sperling raised his voice slightly. Mr. Sperling then wrote an email to Mr. Woodward saying, "I'm really sorry I raised my voice. We're friends, and you know, all I was trying to do is tell you that you're heading down a blind alley, and you'll regret, I'm pretty sure you'll regret the reporting on the story if you keep going the direction you're going." And Bob Woodward wrote him back, I'm doing this from memory, that essentially said, "Thank you for the warning. I value your friendship, blah, 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 blah." And then Bob Woodward extracted from that entire exchange, "I was threatened by a White House staffer that if I kept on this story, I might regret it," and turned it into some sort of thug mob, "sure would be a pity if your family were hurt" kind of threat from the White House. And then opined that, you know, if I were a younger, more frightened reporter, if I were a little more less experienced, I might feel my career is being threatened by this. And this was spun into a 1.5 or 2 day story by all the usual suspects who, you know, suddenly found confirmation that Barack Obama's White House really is run by Chicago thugs and everyone's out to break each other's kneecaps. And we knew it all along. They're a bunch of Bill Ayers, Chicago bomb throwing mobsters who've taken over our pretty White House and let that Kenyan sleep in our bed. And then Politico, to its credit, published the actual newsletters. And I never thought I'd say this, but even Eric Erickson had to say, "Oh, like, is Bob Woodward thinking? Oh, yeah."
Oh, and hell.
Now the story is Bob Woodward was trolling.
Well, apparently Drudge hasn't let it go yet, so.
Doesn't matter how badly he screws up. Mark Halpert will still roll out of bed in the morning in his Ronald Reagan underoos. And the first thing he reads is Matt Drudge, because he rules their world.
They all do. Apparently the whole House Republican caucus starts their day with Drudge. It's amazing.
The first thing they read is that, as you and I were joking earlier this week, they read the Chomsky report.
Yes, that's right.
You know, the Bible of the Beltway. It really
we
is.
We all read the Chomsky report.
All the inside story about all stuff's going on, the vast liberal conspiracy. And what everyone was shocked by, and they shouldn't have been, was what a big fucking asshole Bob Woodward is. And how shameless he is about just drumming up publicity.
Well, thank God he'll have Sean Hannity to help him iron it all out tonight.
This could. It won't, of course. This could, in fact. There was a little window there, and it's closed now. But we could have had an occasion for discussing. Gee, isn't it weird how for some people there are never any consequences for being horribly fucking wrong or lying in print?
You mean like, I'm a registered conservative rather than a registered Republican?
Sean Hannity might very well be a registered conservative. He might be registered with the Conservative Party. I don't know I'm sure there's a conservative party out there somewhere. I'm sure there's a state out there somewhere where you can register by political affiliation, how you feel about things. I have no idea. And I don't care. Sean Hannity was caught screwing a Rhode Island Red. When accused of being a chicken fucker, he said, "No, I'm in a long-term relationship with a Cornish game hen."
Because they're totally different.
But if you know or correspond with or speak to conservatives, you know that this distinction, this ridiculous electron-level hair splitting between being a conservative and a Republican, is terribly important to them.
Yeah.
Because these are the people who spent 8 years sucking George Bush's dick. While liberals said, "You'll be sorry."
Oh, yeah. I mean, and Hannity, you know, announced it's 12 days until George W. Bush is reelected. It's 11 days till George W. Bush is reelected.
It's coming. And so they can't admit that they voted for George Bush. They can't admit they supported him. This was something that Chris Hayes, to his eternal credit, on Saturday briefly mentioned. He went full drift class.
Yes, he did.
He took sort of a moment of personal privilege, which he does sometimes, and said, "Enough of this bullshit about conservatives hating George Bush. Conservatives love George Bush. They applauded him." And somebody corrected him, you know, well, not at first. Yeah, at first you had to have Dick Cheney at his elbow telling him what to do. And that's how conservatives could trust him, because Dick Cheney would be running the show. Like, that's supposed to be reassuring to some people. But once George Bush started, you know, slashing the budget and blowing up deficits and invading the wrong country and torturing people, conservatives loved him.
Yeah.
And they loved him right up until the day he left office. And then they forgot he ever existed, pretend they'd never voted for him. So inside the asylum, this absurd angels, you know, Sean Hannity dancing on the head of a pin, pretending that I'm a conservative, therefore I'm not a Republican, therefore you can't tag me as a tool of the Republican Party, actually matters. It actually is a meaningful arrangement of words on a page that makes them think they're saying something real. If you're not in the asylum, it looks crazy. It looks literally like, wait a minute, you're fucking a slightly different species of chicken.
Yeah.
And pretending that we've gotten the premise completely wrong because, again, we were talking about Rhode Island Reds, and I can't keep talking about chicken fucking without laughing. As an opportunity to have a larger discussion about how absolutely self-deluded the people are who scraped all of their Cheney Bush bumper stickers off and put on a bunch of tri-corner hats and pretended they'd never heard of George Bush, and how to them Sean Hannity makes perfect sense, that would have been an interesting conversation to have. The idea that Bob Woodward can get something this horribly fucking wrong and never miss a meal and never miss a cocktail party, and he'll be invited right back on Meet the Press the next time they want someone on there, is never discussed in any place that I know of other than the liberal side of the blogosphere. Now, if it had been Rahm Emanuel who had paid Bob Woodward a visit, then I would have bought it.
The mayor of Chicago, former chief of staff, would know about that hangnail on his finger and what he had for breakfast and where the hooker was buried and all kinds of stuff. And shame if anything happened to your Cheerios that you had for breakfast. Yeah.
That's a threat,
yeah,
Bob.
That's a threat. And no one would be surprised if Rahm Emanuel was accused of making such a threat. Yes.
No, Gene Sperling, who is
Head of the Council of Economic Advisors for Barack Obama. He didn't do that mob stuff. Yeah.
Oh, Brit Hume. I never thought I'd live to say the phrase, even Brit Hume. But even Brit Hume said, oh, I know Gene Sperling. Nobody has ever been threatened by Gene Sperling.
Yeah.
Bob Woodward, we weren't paying enough attention to him, so he decided to throw a little tantrum and lie a little bit. And again, that's how you do in Washington.
And apparently it gets your name in the papers. So, and on the podcast, I have to apologize for that. But it's related to the whole Chicago thing, kind of tangentially. Every week we post to our website and Facebook page an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitty is Obi. Obi is a beautiful black and white cat who hails from Ireland. We love getting pictures of Internet Kitties from around the world. Feel free to send one to us at our email address, which is proleftpodcast@gmail.com. And that's where you can write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. And be aware that if you write us at that address or at our U.S. Postal Service Go Postal Union address, we reserve the right to read your email or letter on the air unless you say otherwise. So, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Bubble Galley, Internet Kitties are pissed because this is the week they finally decided to seek an audience with the Pope.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dovey. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast. We didn't even mention the sequester once.
No, which means our numbers will be huge. All of the radio and television and newspaper I consume, it is painfully clear that the public has no idea what the hell that is.
Well, and I got to give props to James Carville. I don't often do that, but James Carville said that people don't know what the sequester is, but it sounds cruel, so people assume Republicans have something to do with it. Yeah. And that it's their fault.
They're right.